Not Quite Right features discussions that are unfiltered and uncensored and may include themes that are inappropriate for younger listeners. Also, I swear a lot.
Something doesn't seem quite right.
Welcome to Not Quite Right. My name is Ed. And this is the 10th of a series of interviews that Amanda and I recorded at the Words on the Waves Writers Festival this year. This time, we're speaking with foreign correspondent Peter Grester and economist Sean Turnell, both of whom were falsely imprisoned by foreign governments on espionage and terrorism charges, and who each spent over a year in jail as a result. We spoke to Peter and Sean about their harrowing experiences, what gave them hope, and the effect that their experience has had on their lives. So here's our discussion with Peter Grester and Sean Turnell. So we're here at Words on the Waves with Peter Grester and Sean Turnell.
Thanks very much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And you've just come off a panel called Wrongfully Imprisoned, and you both have a very interesting story to tell. So I'd really love to hear the story of your wrongful imprisonment.
Well, there's a nice summary to it, Peter, which you once used, which was that I was the spy and you were the terrorist. So together we're sort of two antisocial elements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're two very dangerous characters.
Mm-hmm. Apparently. Should we be worried?
Well, apparently, it depends on who you talk to. I was in Egypt in 2013 working for Al Jazeera as a correspondent covering the unfolding political crisis in Egypt when I was arrested on terrorism charges. And ended up being convicted and sentenced to 7 years, whereas Sean here...
Yeah, so I was in Myanmar from 2015 to 2021 as an advisor to the civilian government. Then there was a military coup in 2021 and I was arrested, charged with being a spy, convicted of being a spy, given 4 years, but released after two.
So you only given 4 years, I got seven.
Well, you're the terrorist, so, you know, they take a harder line approach, yeah.
So what does that feel like? You know, you're in a foreign country, you've been wrongfully convicted of these charges, and you must not know if, for example, 7 years, if that's really going to be the sentence.
Kind of have to configure your thinking to 7 years, though. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you think, because when I was convicted, I know how it was for Sean, but for me, up to the point that I was convicted, I always thought that there was a chance that we'd get out.
Mm. You just think justice will prevail. You have a bit of faith.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Have faith. You have hope. And I put hope in inverted commas. Because in the end, I also realized, it was after I was convicted, that I realized that you have to give up on hope, you have to abandon hope. Not in the sense that you quit, that you roll over and give up, but in the sense that you stop thinking about things that are outside of your control and recognize that the only thing I've got I can deal with is the stuff that's right in front of me now, and that is this prison cell. And I might get out at some point soon,
But it might
well be 7 years, and I need to get my head around the idea of 7 years, otherwise I'll go mad.
Mm-hmm. And has that, I guess, shift in thinking served you now in your life? Is it something that you left behind, or is it something that you take with you into your life?
Well, in my weaker moments, I sometimes forget all of those big lessons that I learned. Yeah. You know, it's sort of life overtakes you. But there are times when I stop and think and reflect and say, okay, let's go back and relearn those big lessons around living in the present, dealing with what's in front of me, rather than what I would like or hope for.
The past or future.
Exactly.
And I think just on that, I think the human mind is endlessly adaptable. So these things become incredibly useful during those periods. But your mind does get into a different place, which is, incredibly useful under those sorts of conditions. And sometimes it's applicable in the world outside, but sometimes not. But, I'm really quite taken with the idea about how human beings just adapt to different situations.
Yeah, it becomes all you know, doesn't it? So you just have to operate in that system. I mean, I suppose you could, and I'm sure many people do, fixate on the injustice or fixate on getting out, and to their detriment probably, because what's happening day to day, you've still got to deal with that. You've still got to deal with what you're going to eat today, and you've still got to deal with who you're dealing with around you. And I remember a time when my day job was writing, and it was just technical writing, and I traveled a lot at that time, and I would put on the little, the form, the travel form, I'm a technical writer, and I would get stopped at customs in the places I was traveling to because of the word writer. And I think that's what this is, right? There's countries that are suspicious of you as a writer. Like, what are you going to take out of the country?
But it also speaks to the power of words and the way that the authorities often fear those words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and recognizing those two things, sometimes the way that authorities get completely paranoid about simply what other people will say, but also recognizing that actually words do have power, they do have meaning, and that being able to take ideas and articulate them and publish them is actually a really important, powerful act.
Mm. And that's what journalists are doing all the time, right?
Yeah.
To the point that it's seen as like an act of terrorism by a government.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this comes back to my kind of core thesis. One of the things that I talk about a lot in my book is that what 9/11 did, I kind of locate what I've come to think of as a war on journalism back at starting at 9/11, when George W. Bush, the US president at the time, declared what he described as what he said was a war on terror. Now, I'm not saying that he necessarily explicitly launched an attack on journalism, but what that did was create a war of ideas, over isms, over abstract concepts. And suddenly, in that kind of conflict, the space where ideas are transmitted by definition becomes a part of the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And Bush also basically liberated the rhetoric of national security and gave governments the world over to use national security as a way of coming after uncomfortable ideas,
mm-hmm.
uncomfortable journalism. And that's not an abstract idea. This, what happened to me, and I think to a certain extent, what happened to Sean is a really visceral examples of the ways in which governments take uncomfortable reporting, uncomfortable writing, uncomfortable thinking, and treat that as a threat to national security, as an act of terrorism in my case, and as an act of espionage in Sean's.
Yeah, and also I think the way that many governments around the world fear a loss of control, because my sin, if you like, in the eyes of the military that took over Myanmar, was that we were trying to open Myanmar up to the world. We were trying to loosen and control, et cetera, bring in ideas, exchanges, things like that. And they became quite fearful of that, and a certain paranoia developed, and then an excuse.
Yeah.
Like, as the foreigner was doing these terrible things and, you know, could then be part of their campaign.
So I'm interested then to hear from both of you. You were charged with these crimes and convicted. Were the crimes you were charged with things that you were doing, or was it all trumped up? Like, did you meet their criteria for the crime even?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So I was over in Myanmar as an economic advisor to the president and the prime minister, effectively. So I had access to official documents. That was a routine part of my job. Now, you can then turn that around, though. Once the coup took place and they were imprisoned, et cetera, my access to those documents then became a hostile foreigner with access to official secret documents.
Mm.
So the facts were there.
Yeah.
Like, the fact was I did have access to these documents.
Yeah.
I was interacting with the Myanmar government. I was interacting with the Australian government, the US government, all that. It was totally above board and transparent, but, you know, there were certain facts of,
So you were basically charged because you had the access, or because they assumed you were misusing that access?
Well, so the excuse was that I had misused it. So, but the facts that I had, the access to the documents was just there.
Yeah, you know,
but I had legal right to do that, or authorised right by the civilian government. So, yeah, in a sense, the misuse was the layer that the military put on, that I was actually supplying it to MI6 in my case, and that this was done for nefarious ends.
But then that's interesting to me, because if you're not doing that, where's the proof? It's, if it's all just completely based on what could happen, that obviously just huge miscarriage of justice. So did they invent evidence, or?
They did invent evidence, but in a sense they didn't need to either, because, you know, my title was Special Economic Consultant. Now, if government ministers had not been consulting with me, I wouldn't have been doing my job. But the very fact that they did consult with me was proof in the military's eyes that they were supplying me with official documents and official information that presumably then I was providing to international bodies.
And you were a very good spy, so you did it so secretly they couldn't even prove it.
Oh, I was such a good spy, I got caught.
Yeah. And what about you?
Yeah, so at one level, there was, I suppose, a degree of I was going to say legitimacy. We've been covering the unfolding political crisis in Egypt. And part of that meant speaking to all of the parties involved in the conflict, as journalists are supposed to do. Now, we were talking to the government that was the political party that was last in power, and that was the Muslim Brotherhood. At the time I was arrested, the government had started accusing the Brotherhood of being involved in acts of terrorism, even though nothing we broadcast or published was terrorism-related. Simply by speaking to the Brotherhood and their supporters in the government's narrative, we were therefore engaging and advocating terrorist ideology. Yeah. But the charges went further. We were supposed to be members of a terrorist organization. We were supposed to be financing terrorism. We were supposed to be broadcasting false news with intent to undermine national security. And I remember saying to the lawyer at the time, it's easy there, show us the membership.
Yeah.
Show us the money trail. How is it that we were supposed to be financing terrorism? And that never came up.
They didn't bother with that. It's just, you just have to say it happened. And
yeah, exactly. And that was it. There was a sort of broad conspiracy, right? Mm. That Al Jazeera, which was financed by the Qatari government, and the Qataris had also supported the Brotherhood, and because we worked for Al Jazeera, therefore, sort of tie the whole thing up in a neat bow, we must be part of this terrorist conspiracy. Never mind that me and my two colleagues were charged with terrorism offences, and never mind that there was zero evidence that we were actually done any of that stuff. That it was
the
really
association.
It was guilty by association.
Yeah.
I'm interested. You raised this idea of like the legacy of George W. Bush and 9/11, and I guess the criminalization almost of your journalistic practices. We're obviously in the Trump's second term now, and there's a lot being said about the way that he's treating journalism and free press. Do you see echoes of the way that you were treated?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's the way, if you look at Trump's rhetoric, he talks about the press as if it's the enemy of the people. Mm-hmm. He talks about it using that sort of rhetoric of security. Famously, the Washington Post, when Bush declared that they were the enemy of the people, they were at war with Trump. The editor of the Washington Post famously retorted, "Mr. President, we're not at war, we're at work." Mm. It's using that same rhetoric, as I said, of national security to attack uncomfortable reporting that I think does echo back to our time in Egypt, but also to the rhetoric that Bush unleashed.
Which is very ironic and hypocritical, coming from, as it often does, proponents of free speech in these places.
Yeah.
I just think in Australia, we have the luxury, I guess, of assuming that we've got this separation of powers, that the courts don't act in the interests of the government, and that there is a level of just objectivity about things. At least we like to imagine that's the case.
The trouble is that the courts still have to work with the laws that they're given.
That's true.
And one of the problems in Australia is that we've got no constitutional restraint, no constitutional protection for press freedom or freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that Australia is about to become Egypt anytime soon. Let me be really clear. But what we're seeing is the way it is national security legislation without that constitutional obligation to protect press freedom and freedom of speech. A whole host of national security laws have been passed over the recent years, since 9/11, in ways that chip away at that space that we're able to operate in.
Yeah.
And that has really serious consequences. We're not seeing journalists being locked up, but you only need to look at a couple of the very famous examples of David McBride and Richard Boyle, two whistleblowers, two journalist sources who have both been punished for their revelations. David McBride lost his appeal against his 6-year sentence for disclosing evidence of war crimes by Australian Special Forces to the ABC. Richard Boyle has been forced to plead guilty for recording and documenting confidential tax information as a part of his disclosures to the Sydney Morning Herald about abusive practices by the tax office. Now, in a world where those sources who revealed stories of really insidious abuses of government power and overreach of government power, where those guys themselves are being punished rather than the people that were responsible for those abuses. There is something fundamentally wrong about that system.
And I think most people feel the same way. So it's interesting that these things still happen right in front of our eyes. And he was sort of saying about 9/11 and changes in laws for national security. And of course, in Australia, one of the big ones was the change to this rule that you can arrest on suspicion of terrorism. And there's always been a reasonableness test for arrest in this country, and that's just completely removed. And we don't see that bit, that power being abused necessarily, but that law exists, and that frightens me. When that law came in, I'm like, what, we just arrest someone because we say they're a terrorist. Now the police have the power to arrest, and they just, that's all they need to say. They don't need to justify it. They don't need to provide any proof or evidence, as they might, for example, if they suspected you of carrying drugs. So yeah, we've got this foot in the door, and what happens then?
And that's, I think, a real problem. And the courts are in a difficult position, I think, because they have to work with the legislation as it is written.
Mm.
And again, if we just very quickly go back to, say, the David McBride story, the ABC tried to overturn the search warrant that the police used to come after the evidence of David McBride's involvement using what's called the implied right of political communication, which is a thing that the High Court has inferred in the Constitution. But the court said, listen, we can't do that because we've got a very clear warrant written against a very clear statute that says it's a criminal offence to reveal or disclose classified information. You're asking us to overturn that against some vaguely inferred right.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do that. That the law is, it's written there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't matter what we might think is right. The fact is that the law pushes the court into that kind of position. So it's a situation where we're seeing our own civil liberties, our own ability to work as journalists, to hold government account, to blow the whistle, to push back against the awesome power of government because of the way laws have been passed in the name of national security and the war on terror. And I think that is a problem.
Mm. I'm just curious too, because we're here at a writers' festival, you know, and interested in your writing experiences. It must be somewhat, I imagine, re-traumatizing to write these memoirs of your experiences. What is that like for you? What was it like for you, Sean?
Oh, yeah, I found exactly the opposite.
Did you?
Yes.
Okay, I'm glad to hear it.
I wrote most of the book in my head in the prison.
Okay.
So the first emotion was one of relief, of getting it out of my head and onto the paper. That was number one, but also a very strong objective to pay tribute to my Burmese friends who had saved my life and all that, and also to tell the story of Myanmar, all the terrible things going on. So, yeah, for me it was quite exciting, and if anything, sort of relieving my brain of a burden, and in particular just this idea of getting what was in my head in black and white. Mm. So, yeah, didn't find it re-traumatizing.
Okay.
Yeah, I think sort of affirming, if you like, and part of the plan that I had to do after being relieved.
And funnily enough, they didn't give you access to paper and a pencil while you were in
They didn't. And I remember the tension when I got back to Australia and all the fun stuff and seeing everyone and all the excitement and so on. But there was a little voice at the back of my head saying, okay, Sean, all this is really good, but you've got to get a pen, you've got to start writing.
Mm.
And able to do that a few days later.
Yeah. Oh, I'm very happy to hear that. What about you, Peter? Do you share
same,
that?
Exactly, yeah? The same as Sean. Okay. Yeah. I felt that the story, I wanted to tell the story as a way of pushing back.
Mm.
And applying meaning, arranging, because it would have been 400 days of my life that was lost.
Yes.
By writing it down, by creating the book, I'm layering meaning, I'm drawing meaning out of that, and therefore making that experience meaningful, not a waste of my time, not meaningless. But it's also about pushing back. So the Egyptians tried to shut me up. They tried to take away my voice as a journalist. By writing the book, by also speaking about it at book festivals and so on, it's a way of saying to the Egyptians, screw you.
Mm-hmm.
You tried to take my voice, but you made it worse for yourselves. You've given me a platform that I would never otherwise have had.
To expose it all.
To expose it all, to talk about this, to turn it against the Egyptians in a way and say, I'm not going to play this game. I'm going to use my book. I'm going to use my voice as a way of fighting back. And in the process, adding value to that time you took away.
And also just that simple pleasure of extending the middle finger to our...
Yeah, a luxury for some, yeah.
I'm wondering, has the experience changed, I guess especially for yourself, Peter, as a journalist, your relationship with journalism, or is there any, I don't want to say fear, but still have the same level of enthusiasm for being a correspondent, for travelling the world, or is there somewhere in the back of your head this kind of idea that it could happen again?
So I'm absolutely determined to keep traveling. I mean, the world has been my life as a foreign correspondent for a huge chunk of my professional career, I still have, and I still regret the fact that I can't be a correspondent any longer. I still have a terrorism conviction.
Are you able to travel?
Well, it's complicated. Yeah. I mean, you can. We both do, but both Sean and I have the same problem.
A lot of pat-downs and
that,
a lot of...
Yeah, that when you apply for visas, if those visa applications ever ask if you've been convicted of any criminal offence, we both have to say yes, and then...
Even for employment, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Lifelong burden.
And, of course, that very real risk of extradition.
Yeah.
Because both of us have, in a sense, outstanding prison warrants for our arrest.
Do you still now? Yeah. Because, well, so when you... got out, you hadn't served the periods that you each were sentenced to. How did you get out? Was that because of Australian intervention?
Yeah. For mine, it was overtly political. It was Australia, but it was also the US in particular, putting pressure. So I was given a special pardon. But as soon as I got back to Australia and I started speaking out, the pardon was lifted, an arrest warrant reissued. So,
So you've got to be careful where you go just in case they side with the other side. And what about you?
And in my case, I still don't know what it was that ultimately got me out. I mean, there was just layers and layers of pressure from all sorts of different points. And finally, it became too much. And I was released on an order of the president. But the trouble was I was released. It's a bit complicated. So bear with me. We were convicted. We appealed the conviction. And won the appeal, the conviction was overturned and a retrial was ordered. Before the retrial could begin, I was taken out of the country on an executive order. But when the retrial began, I was really surprised to discover that I was still named as a defendant, along with my two colleagues who were still also in prison. At the end of the retrial, we were all reconvicted and given fresh sentences. Now, my two colleagues, about 3 or 4 weeks later, were given pardons and released, but the pardon didn't extend to me. So I still carry that conviction and there is still a prison sentence waiting for me.
So we're in the room here with a couple of wanted men, basically.
Yes, you are. You should be afraid.
Yeah, very afraid.
Yeah, so I mean, despite those, I guess, travel restrictions and things that you've got to be worried about, it sounds like it hasn't diminished your enthusiasm for, I guess, justice.
Yeah.
I can feel it in Sean too. It's given a bit of fire in my belly.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, amazing story. Should we just mention your books? So, Peter, you've written about this in a book called The Correspondent. And Sean?
An Unlikely Prisoner.
And The Correspondent is now a movie as well.
So, yes. What's that experience like?
Oh, it's very weird. Very, very weird.
Yeah.
Not every day that you have Richard Roxburgh playing you on a big screen.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if my love story was ever that interesting that they would get Richard Roxburgh in for the lead role, but...
I didn't think Richard Roxburgh would be very credible as you.
No, for some reason.
A little bit.
Nice to know, though, that he's credible for you, right? That must be a nice feeling.
It's been a real trip.
Well, a fascinating story. Thank you both for speaking with us today.
Yeah,
thank you so much. Thank you.
This has been a special presentation of the Not Quite Right podcast in collaboration with Words on the Waves Writers Festival. Check the show notes for more information about Words on the Waves and the books mentioned in this episode. If you're new to the podcast, please join us again for our regular episodes where we talk about media, culture, and the art of writing.
Something doesn't seem quite right.